This is Sheila with the Communicate Influence podcast. In this episode, I speak with Alan Hunkins, author of one of the best books that I've read about leadership in many years. His book, Cracking the Leadership Code, takes an in-depth look at the psychology of leadership and how our formative years can shape us and our ability to be good leaders. Why so far back? Well, says Alan, leadership is all about understanding yourself and leading yourself first. With that in place, you can work towards building the three pillars of strong leadership: connection, communication, and collaboration. If you want to learn more about leadership with Alan, head over to his website and take a look at his 30-day leadership challenge set to start on Wednesday, May 19th. You can find the details in the show notes. Before we go to the interview, I encourage you to take a look at podthreads.com. Podthreads is a new online clothing store for podcasters and podcast fans. Its focus is on helping raise funds for independent podcasters. That's podthreads.com. Now, let's join Alan for our interview. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the Communicate Influence podcast.
Oh, thanks so much, Sheila. I'm very excited for our conversation today.
I am too. I'm excited to talk to you about this book that you've written last year, Cracking the Leadership Code. It's a brilliant book. I recommend it to everyone who's listening. I listened to it on Audible and feel like I learned so much. And there were many times that I felt like I was reading a really intriguing and interesting book about psychology. It was so much about behavior and self-awareness. But before we jump into that, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah, I certainly didn't grow up at the age of five. I didn't think I'm going to be a leadership consultant, author, coach, and facilitator. But you know, if I was to look backwards and tell you a little bit about my story and how I got here, yeah, my focus is very much around the psychology and behavior of leaders. And I think I've been very keenly interested in human behavior and psychology ever since I was a boy. And I write about this in the book. In fact, I tell this story because I grew up in a fairly unique household. So I grew up in New York City. That's not particularly unique. I was raised by a single mom, also not unique. And my grandmother lived with us, my mom's mom. Again, none of those things are unique. The unique part about that experience is that both my mother and my grandmother are Holocaust survivors. So my mother was born in 1935 in Brussels, Belgium. So when the Nazis invaded Belgium in 42, my mom's 7 years old, she was actually taken and put in the Belgian underground for Jewish children and spent over 3 years in the underground during the war, where she didn't see her mom and was separated from everyone she knew. At the same time, my grandmother was trying to elude capture. She actually was captured and imprisoned and put in a concentration camp and miraculously survived the war. And the two of them were reunited, whereas most of the rest of the family was killed. So why I share this in the book, and I think it's really shaped me, because when those two people become my primary caregivers and parents, they have a very specific worldview, which is based on lack of trust. I mean, based on living through wartime trauma. And that profoundly shaped how they raised me. And one of the things I noticed growing up in New York City in the 1970s was my experience at school was so different than it was at home, or when I was at my friends' houses, or even going to see my dad on the weekends because my parents were divorced. And so I think part of my interest in human behavior came out of, why is it that when you're in some organizations, there's some kind of vibe, and when you're in other organizations, there's a completely different vibe? It turns out the difference is all due to the leadership. And so my work has been a study of why some leaders do a great job of creating a culture or an environment where people can thrive, and other leaders really don't. And that's really, so I started with that. I studied psychology in undergrad. I actually have a graduate degree in theater and acting, and then got involved teaching arts and education, conflict resolution, leadership training in schools, and then transitioned to working in businesses and organizations about 25 years ago. So I've worked with over 2,000 groups in 25 countries since then. So the work and the book, Cracking the Leadership Code, wasn't something I just sat down out of nowhere. It actually was written from the ground up. It's actually in some ways a distillation of all the stories and the examples of the people and the leaders I worked with over these years. So that's really what's gotten me to be where I am here today.
I mean, you've had amazing experience and diverse as well, but that, I remember listening to that story, and it is quite a painful and moving story. It must have been so hard for you. And a couple of thoughts came to mind when I was listening to it. One was that that's a very personal thing to reveal about yourself, because, you know, some people can judge quite harshly and they think, oh, dysfunction, you know, what's this person really like? And next, you're an absolutely amazing human being, having gone through that experience to be, you know, seemingly so well-rounded. When I look at your work and look at what you've written and the depth of learning that you've undergone, those were the two things that came to mind.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sheila. So it's interesting, you know, because you talk about, you know, oh, that must have been such a horrible experience. And I would beg to differ in that when you go through it, when I went through it, it's all I knew. I thought that was normal. Right. And so one of the things, I mean, the nature of trauma, and I think everyone can relate to trauma because the coronavirus pandemic is a trauma, and everyone responds to trauma in different ways. And so to answer the second part about, you know, how did that shape me? Not that I say that I would wish that experience on anyone. However, I feel like, you know, to use the metaphor, I took the lemons that were given to me in my upbringing and I squeezed them and made some great lemonade. The fact is, I think because my interest, and you know, I was profoundly thinking about these very deep questions around life and death at the age of 7, 8, 9. I mean, this is not a normal thing that normal kids go through. And I've taken that experience and I've turned it into, you know, and we could say that, you know, out of your wounds come your biggest gifts. And so for me, I think the gift of self-awareness, the gift of interest and insight and being like a dog with a bone and persistence, why is this way? And studying, that's the gift that experience gave me. And so I've, you know, they talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. There's also post-traumatic growth syndrome. And I think that I've taken whatever trauma that it was given to me and looked for ways to grow from it. Now, are there parts of it? You know, I'm not here to say I'm perfect. I've done a lot of work on myself, you know, whether that's in therapy or in group settings or just going to tons of workshops. But part of that was me trying to heal some of the parts that were standing in my way so that I could both grow personally, but then also so I would have more to offer to the world. Because what I keep finding is that the best way to be happy is to stop focusing on your own happiness and try to help other people. And so that's what I've been trying to do with my work, is to try to, how can I help other people? In some ways, I get to forget about myself and really focus on how can I make the world a more brilliant place for them.
But there are so many people who have that kind of experience and they don't get over it. And that's not a criticism of them.
Yeah.
And actually, personally, I don't like that phrase, get over it, because I think, you know, we learn how to adjust and adapt and do the best with, you know, with what we have and grow. Yeah. So what do you think made you different? What made you so able to accomplish everything that you've accomplished?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I would agree. I don't think you do get over it. I think the way out is through. I don't think you get over it. You go through it. And going through it is scary. It's really scary. You know, I honestly, you know, I couldn't tell you like what, why am I different in whatever way? I mean, for me, I think it's been partially, I have followed what's been interesting to me in terms of my own pursuits at whatever time. So for example, in undergraduate school, I didn't know what I wanted to focus on. So I dabbled in a lot of different things. And when it was time to be a senior, I saw a lot of my friends were getting haircuts and buying suits and starting to, you know, interview at investment banks and advertising agencies. And that was not at all where I was. I was like, what are you doing? How can I, you know, at the time I didn't know what I wanted to do, but what I figured out was I had written a couple of plays that I had enjoyed and they had been produced on the college campus. So I thought, let me do an internship at a theater. So I did that. And so I spent a good part of my 20s trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And at the same time, I must have gotten lucky. I had a couple of mentors who turned me on to some ideas and to some workshops where suddenly I got involved in, we'll call it personal growth or personal development. And it was so empowering. I remember the first time I went to, it was a community building workshop that was run by a group called the Foundation of for Community Encouragement, which was founded by, you may remember, the author Scott Peck, who wrote a famous book called The Road Less Traveled. So I'm sitting in this workshop, and the whole goal of the workshop is to build intentional community. I won't go into all the details, but there's four phases of community. And you're there for 2 days. You're there in a circle with a facilitator for 2 days with a group of 30 people. And I remember early in the first day, this woman next to me starts sharing something very personal and very vulnerable. And as she's sharing this about herself, and it had to do with one of her own wounds. And as she's sharing this, I get this amazing experience of like gratitude, because I'm sitting here next to her going, oh my gosh, I'm not the only person on the planet who's screwed up, right? I had never heard anyone ever share anything like that publicly in front of me, that level of vulnerability. And suddenly I went, oh my gosh, it isn't just me. Because again, up to that point, all of my own doubts, anxieties, insecurities, I thought it was just me. Because you look at the world, and if you really want to get this on steroids, just go on social media where everyone's life is perfect and everyone seems so put together. Whereas behind the facade, people are struggling. People have lives and they have dreams that are not coming to fruition, and they're challenged and they've got wounds, whatever. And so that whole experience of that workshop and further workshops was like, wow, the way through it is to go into it and out, as opposed to just, don't deal with it. And I think when people don't deal with it, what ends up happening is we need to medicate it in some way, whether that's through drugs or alcohol or overwork or, buying more toys, whatever that might be, right? There's ways to, and I've had the fortune to work with thousands and thousands of people. And I realized that, underneath all of these layers, you have all of us at a certain, and now it looks different for different people, but all of us want to be seen. All of us want to be heard. All of us want to be recognized. We all want to be valued and affirmed. And there are things, and we've all, in some level, been, we've been exposed to messages that have told us, you're not okay. This isn't good enough. If only you do this, then I'll love you, right? All that conditional stuff. And I think part of the journey of being human and of maturing is to learn how to, quiet down those messages that are standing in the way of your own potential. And so that's what my work has really been focused on, is looking at the beliefs. And there's two ways to focus on it. You can start from the outside in, which is focus on the behaviors first. And if you shift the behaviors, like changing your habits, that will start to shift your beliefs. The other way to work on it is from the inside out, which is to take a look at the beliefs you have, the mindset you have, and take a look at what are the stories that I've been telling myself, and where did I pick up these stories, and are these stories actually serving me, and is there a new story I want to tell? So anyway, this all gets into the detail of we as humans have work to do. And like we said, the way is not to get over it, it's to go through it.
And as you were speaking there, I can really understand how your experiences and your mentors must have influenced you, but that experience in therapy and understanding the whole experience of going through something, how that has influenced cracking the leadership code, because a lot of what you write about is being authentic and understanding yourself and that self-awareness before you can go anywhere near being empathetic, understanding others, communicating well, and leading well.
So true. It's funny. I was asked last week, I was mentoring a group of young men through an organization that I'm affiliated with. And they said to me, so, in your book, you write about being a leader and, these three secrets of building strong leaders being connection, communication, and collaboration. He said, how do you do that if you don't lead anybody? And so I pushed back. I said, first of all, you do lead. My definition of leadership is not a title or a position. It's really, leadership is any time any of us are trying to influence anyone to get something done. That is leadership. And if you think about it, we're all leading ourselves every day. And if the cornerstone of good leadership is connection, the first person that I need to connect with is myself. Mm-hmm. And so, so my work for myself of doing that kind of uncovering, peeling away those layers of self-awareness, part of why I feel comfortable being as authentic as I am is, when you've been through and done the work, and I'll just give an example of where you have grieved so hard and cried so much that you didn't know that there were any tears left, and then found out that, you know what? The world woke up the next day and the sun came out. It's still spinning. Like, life goes on. Mm-hmm. There's something incredibly healing and nurturing about the fact that, wow, the world can hold my pain. And knowing that, that it's safe, you know, and obviously it's hard to do on your own if you have no training. But, you know, mm-hmm. if you can find those supports, whether that's professional supports or a really good friend or a group, somehow find those people who can support you to be able to let go and unburden yourself of all that stuff that is getting in your way. Because, you know, the first person you need to connect to so that you can be the leader you want to become is yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. Learn to lead yourself first.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when I was starting to read your book, I thought to myself, one question that came up was that I want to ask you is, why are we still dealing with this problem? I've worked in organizations, and you will have heard all these stories where people are having so many problems with their leaders. Now, I'm kind of getting close to the end stage of my career, and it was like that at the beginning. So that's spanning kind of 30 plus years. And it seems to me as though things haven't really changed that much when it comes to leadership. And I've worked in Britain and in Canada, and the problems seem to exist everywhere.
They do.
Why isn't something shifting or changing?
It's such a good question, Sheila. You know, because the journey of leadership, of effective, authentic, you know, really great leadership, is a journey that everyone has to take on their own. And if you look at the nature of hierarchical organizations, which most of us work in, whether it's the family, which frankly is a hierarchy for most of us, or a for-profit or not-for-profit organization, you could work for the government for that example, there's a hierarchy, there's a boss you report to. So one of the challenges of hierarchy is that when people get into positions of power, and they say, you've heard the expression that, you know, power is an intoxicant, right? And so when people are in these positions of power, they're not likely to say, I'm in this leadership role. What my job really is to do is to unlock the potential in others. And the best way to do that is to ask the people I lead, and this is a servant leadership mindset they would be having, the best thing to do is to ask them, what can I be doing better to serve you? Because that's like the parent asking the child for feedback. And most of us are like, I'm in charge. Why do you have to do this? Because I say so. That's why. Now, I'm taking that maybe to a slight extreme. But the fact is, most of us have been acculturated to what we'll call old school command and control hierarchical leadership. And that is in us physically, viscerally, in our bones. And most of us got it in our initial organization, which was with our families of origin. You know, because in the moment, it is so much easier for a leader to say, do this because I say so, because I'm your dad, that's why. And so that works for a point. You know, you'll get compliance to a point until you don't. So if you have teenagers, they start to rebel, which is the classic. Of course, they'll rebel if you feel like you've been doing stuff to them and they haven't been understood at all. So we have inherited this legacy of command and control leadership. And so we can go, yes, but it's 2021. Shouldn't we be more advanced? Only if we're willing to do the work and change the paradigm. And unfortunately, so few people have had actual healthy role models of what I call the facilitative mindset, this different way of leading, where instead of being the commander in chief, you're the facilitator in chief. And unless leaders take it upon themselves to say, you know what, this old way of working isn't working, I need to find a different way, because they already have the power, they have the control, they have the paycheck, whatever, that's a lot of work they don't want to do. And so they just keep doing what they did, even though it's not particularly effective, but because no one's going to call them on it and it's not going to put them out of a job, they just keep doing what they do. And net-net is that the sum total of the state of the leadership nation is poor. Now, I write about this in the book, but, you know, about 23% of people think that their leaders in organizations are effective. Again, it's a shockingly low number, and that number has not risen. It's been like that for decades. So I think that's why we are in the state that we're in, and that You know, we can't wait for somebody else to start to shift that paradigm. It is up to each of us individually to say, yeah, this is maybe good, but is it where I want to be? And if it's not, what am I willing to do to make that happen?
Mm. Would you go as far as to suggest that leaders should go through a round of psychotherapy before they become leaders or before they assume a new position?
You know, I don't necessarily psychotherapy. I think, you know, for one thing, I think one thing that would be really helpful, you know, is we want leaders who are emotionally intelligent. And for those that aren't that familiar with emotional intelligence or EQ, there's some basic competencies that are associated with emotional intelligence. And the number one, the first competency is self-awareness. Are you even aware of how you show up to yourself? And I think a really valuable tool to help leaders on that path is a 360-degree instrument, right? Where basically you're getting feedback from people above you, on the side of you, yourself, and those that report to you, how they see you. Now, if you're just basically taking a 360 and hold your breath as a tick box exercise, like, oh, I got to get through this so I can just do my thing, you're not going to get any value out of it. However, so I'm suggesting this because I don't think you need psychotherapy. And it's, you know, leadership isn't about necessarily healing your deepest wounds on the job. You know, that might be an extreme case, but more it's a sense of, are you open to giving and receiving feedback, specifically receiving feedback of how you're showing up? And if somebody says, hey, you know, Sheila, the way you lead this meeting isn't working for me in this way, and here's why, are you willing to hear that and go, thank you for the feedback, I'm willing to adjust my strategy moving forward? So I think that's the key, is that we take the feedback and then we apply it. But to take feedback, we have to be willing to be much more malleable with our egos. And for many of us, that's too scary. Because, so I wouldn't call it psychotherapy. Maybe it's going to acting school. In acting school, you have to learn how to do that really well early on. You have to learn how to separate yourself when the director is giving you notes about the character you're playing. So for example, if I'm playing Hamlet and the director's saying, oh, Hamlet needs to do this, like, oh, that's not Alain, that's Alain playing the role of Hamlet. The fact is, we're all playing roles every day, and we have to learn to stop taking feedback as a personal affront on our value as a human being. It's not. It's more of, you're in this role, you're in a management role at work. Okay, as my manager, this isn't working for me. What can you do differently? And then to hold it more lightly, and then we can start to adjust and change. So I'd say getting feedback, getting coaching, getting, people are really bad at judging ourselves. I mean, just, you know, one of my colleagues, Tasha Yurick, has this wonderful book called Insight. And she says, like, only about, I think it's 12 to 14% of the population has any real degree of self-awareness. So do things that will bump up your level of awareness so that you can be much more effective.
I mean, one of the things about that question that I asked about psychotherapy and is it necessary, it could to some listeners sound a little bit extreme, but you know, we often read, don't we, that X percentage of leaders are kind of in the narcissistic zone of the personality spectrum. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you know, experts say that we all have narcissistic tendencies, and some of them are for quite healthy reasons. But when it becomes extreme and you know, you couple that with this sense of power over individuals, it can be very, very harmful and destructive. And, you know, I think of some of the places that people work, and you often hear people tossing around the word, oh, he's a narcissist. It seems very common these days. So when organizations are appointing new marketing managers, CMOs, or communications directors, what traits should they be looking for in this assessment process that might stand out as red flags?
I think there's a really simple test that you can put people through to find out a little bit in terms of like a window into their psyche. And I got this from Robert Reich, who used to be the Secretary of Labor of the United States under Bill Clinton. He calls it the pronoun test. Notice, what kind of pronouns do people use when they're describing their accomplishments? Are they saying, I did this, I did this, I did this? Or do they say, we did this, we did this, we did this, right? It tells you a lot about how people see those around them. Like you said, Sheila, there's a lot of people who are, you know, have narcissistic tendencies. And here's the thing about that, you know, the label once we label someone a narcissist or not, then what do we do with it, especially in a work context? I mean, we're not here to clinically diagnose people. It's more of a question to me of, so are you in a position to be effective? So I would look towards, if I'm looking to hire someone for these roles, is talk to me about how you work with the people around you. And I would look to get 360 feedback from others to get a sense of them. And you know, there's a lot of organizations. I remember years ago, Whole Foods used to talk about when someone was getting hired for an associate level position, they were hired by the team that they would work with. And then they were on probation from that team. So basically, you have to prove it to the team that you are either a part of or going to be leading. So if we shift some of these paradigms around how people show up, how they're valued, how they're compensated, I mean, we got to start changing the equation, because this idea of the leader as the hero is an outdated model. The fact is, the goal now is, you know, there's not one person who's going to come in with all the knowledge. I mean, in this knowledge information age that we live in, you know, our data is everywhere. And so what we need now, are we leaders who can facilitate moving information from where it is to where it needs to be and helping, you know, I think something like 75% of people spend most of their time working in collaboration in teams most of the day. So we need leaders who are great facilitators and conveners of teams. And those are a very different skill set than they were even 20, 25 years ago.
That's so true. Now, for my audience, and we talked about this when we were off air, a lot of my listeners work in communications, public relations, or marketing. And what would you say to people who are rising in their career and they're about to lead a team, comms, marketing? How can they get it right? How can they start off on the right foot?
Great. A couple things around this. So number one, in fact, I was just coaching someone on this last week who's just stepped into a new role as a leader. And said, okay, I'm a leader. And actually was promoted from a group of peers who happened to be friends. So if you're new in this role, the first thing is to realize is your leadership success is dependent on the success of those you lead. So if that is just a given, that's just how it works. And if they succeed, you succeed. If they fail, you fail, right? Like you're completely tied into them. So if that's the case, why be a mind reader? Why try to guess the best way to serve them? Instead, what if you went to this new team? So you're the head of, you're the new CMO, and you've got the marketing team you're now head of. Why not go on a listening tour and interview people, whether it's in small focus groups or somehow, but to connect with them and say, great, if you were me, what would you do? What's the thing you wouldn't do? Talk to me. How can I serve you? How can I support you? How can I set you up for success? And you know, the more people you talk to, the more data points. And from there, you can start to create a strategy. So, you know, Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, talks about when he came in 2014, Microsoft was very much a culture of know-it-alls. Everyone had to be the smartest guy in the room. And I say guy because they were mostly men. Hmm. And his whole thing was to change the Microsoft culture. Is we had to take and turn this culture of know-it-alls into a culture of learn-it-alls. And so if you're familiar with the work of Carol Dweck and mindset, it's about how do we have these growth mindsets instead of fixed mindsets. So have this growth mindset, be a learn-it-all, and reach out to the people around you. Oh, and by the way, Satya Nadella has managed to go, you know, the Microsoft, you know, they've been wildly successful under his 7 years. I think they've multiplied their market cap by six, right? Going from like $250 billion to something like $2 trillion in market cap. So it's working. And it just makes sense. It works. It's a principle. So the first thing I suggest is ask people what they think and don't rush in, because you don't need to prove to anybody else how smart you are. You already have the job. See, this is one of the issues I see with leaders time and time again is this. Underneath, we just don't trust ourselves enough. So it's constant, like, let me tell you this and let me add a little more value just to prove my point. You know, instead of sharing three great examples of how this works, we feel the need to share 19 different examples. And, you know, anyone in communications know one of the hallmarks of great communication is simplicity, that in order for people to learn more, you have to teach less. And so we have to come in, be simple, be approachable, and listen, go on that listening tour. And then turn around and then based on what people have given their input to, they're going to be so much more invested in the outcome. You know, there's a wonderful quote from Lao Tzu who talks about leadership. This is thousands of years ago, who said, "The worst leaders people despise, the good leaders people revere, but the best leaders are the ones where the people say, we did it ourselves." So I think having that Lao Tzu idea of being a facilitative leader and bringing people on the journey with you is going to serve you in good stead, no matter what functional role you're in.
So great advice, great comments about how to become a good leader. Focus on gathering information first and don't rush into making decisions. Get to know the people that you're leading.
Yes.
Before you suddenly implement changes or kind of go off on a tangent and say, oh, this is what we're going to do. Yeah. Now, for people in public relations, communications, and particularly internal communications, there's this issue around, you know, getting a seat at the table and being heard by the C-suite and becoming a respected peer. And it's an age-old issue.
Yes.
That some people have been able to resolve successfully, but others in the industry are frustrated with it. What could change that? How can people work with leaders to become better recognized for the qualified individuals that they are?
Great, great question. And I'm going to answer it by sharing a story that I heard. I heard Jack Welch. So for those that don't know Jack Welch, he was the former CEO of General Electric through their heyday in the 80s, was considered at one point the world's best CEO. So I got to hear Jack Welch, this is after he retired from his position at GE. He was giving an interview to a live audience, and there was a Q&A at the end. And someone asked him, he said, Mr. Welch, may I ask you a question? So I'm 25, I've just been promoted to my first management job. What did you do as the 25-year-old Jack Welch that put you on the trajectory to be where you are today versus your peers around you? And I think this, what he said is exactly the answer to your question, Sheila. He said, so basically, when I was 25, he said, our managers would give us stuff to do. And like all of us, we're dutiful and we do it. So if you're in comms, you're like, okay, here's a communication strategy, go and do it. That, he said, that's the ticket to entry. That's the baseline. He said, you will never really advance that far if that's all you do is do what is asked of you. He said, when I was 25, when my boss would ask me to go and do something, yes, of course, I will do it. But beyond that, I would try to figure out what is the bigger business challenge or problem that my boss is facing, why they're asking me this question. And so then when I'd come back, yes, I would bring the solution, but I would also bring three other solutions to the bigger problem they were facing and start to share that and have that dialogue. So I think what Welch demonstrates, and I think so for lots of internal comms people, is we're so focused on the what we're trying to do that we're forgetting the people that are asking us for the what have a bigger why. And so what we need to do is build relationships where we can understand what is the bigger rationale, the why, and then for us to use our communications expertise and skill to start solving for the bigger why and bring those solutions to the table. And when we start doing that, they're going to pull up a chair to give us a seat at the table.
That's great advice, Alan. The key there is obviously, as you said, to think about the bigger picture and also be more focused on what you can do to assist and support from a broader perspective, not just on the task at hand.
Exactly. Good recap.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about? Is there anything that I've not asked you that you'd like to?
Oh my gosh. I mean, we could talk for days.
Yeah, we could, couldn't we?
Yeah, we could. This is
fascinating.
Great questions. I mean, there's so many aspects in that. We've given a good taste of everything, you know, and, you know, sometimes people ask me, you know, what's the number one thing you recommend for aspiring leaders who want to get better? And we've talked about that actually already, which is seek out feedback, you know, really seek feedback. It's so interesting. So few people do. So if you just start to go down the path of I am deliberately intentional about my own improvement and I start by feedback, that's going to put you in the top 2% right there. Just that very act. Because let's face it, humans we're creatures of habit and we like homeostasis. We don't like to rock the boat so much. So your willingness to stretch yourself out in that way is going to separate you. So that's what I would recommend to anybody who's thinking about what they can do to start to grow on their path of becoming a better leader.
That's good. And tell people where we can find you online and the name of your book again.
Sure. Well, I'm going to send you right to the book website here. So it's www.crackingtheleadershipcode.com. So you can learn all about the book there. While you're there, you can download the first chapter of the book. That will also connect you to the alainhunkins.com website, where you can learn all about the work that I do. One of the things that I offer about 3 or 4 times a year is a online 30-day leadership challenge, where you can work with other leaders from literally around the world in an asynchronous format, 5 to 10 minutes a day, and practice these skills of connection, communication, and collaboration to become a better leader. So you can learn all about that there. And if you want to connect with me, LinkedIn is my social media platform of choice.
That's great. And what a fantastic idea, that asynchronous connection with other leaders. That's brilliant.
Thanks.
How long have you been doing that?
We ran our first cohort in October. Our first open cohort was in October. We've run 3 since. And the next one will be starting, I'm not sure when this will air, but May 17th, 2021. And we'll be publishing. And then also I've brought the challenges in-house to work with companies in-house. We're doing some amazing cultural changes using the principles of the book and the challenge.
Oh, great. It's been really wonderful chatting with you. And as you said, I'm sure we could speak for much, much longer on your experiences and also about the content of your book.
Sheila, it's been a real pleasure. I appreciated the depth of the conversation and your questions. And thank you for having me.